and welcome to the 23rd episode of AD Game Club, the monthly video game club podcast where we choose a game from the past to play and talk about in depth. This month, we will be discussing the 2008 tactical JRPG, Valkyria Chronicles. I am your host, Andrew, and joining me today is my best friend and co-host, David.
Welcome, bro. I'm stoked for you. You're here, man. What can I do for you?
How about every modification to my tank ever?
Okay. Do you have infinite money? Probably.
I do seem to get paid a lot as a commander of this army.
Of the militia.
Of the militia. You're right. You're right. You're right. Yes. So, before we start talking about Valkyria Chronicles, though, I would like to mention that AD Game Club has a Facebook page. You can find it at facebook.com/ADGameClub. There you can keep up to date with us throughout the month and participate in the conversation by leaving comments. Anything you want to say before we get into it this month?
No, let's just get into it.
Let's get into it. So, the Valkyria Chronicles was developed and released in 2008 by Sega WoW /Overworks/CS2. It turns out internal studios get restructured into new studios a lot. Apparently. Keeping track of which studio is which is pretty hard. But basically, from my research, this is the same team that made games like Skies of Arcadia and Sakura Wars before. Which the main reason I'm saying this is because a previous month we talked about Banner Saga, and I don't remember if I found out in time for the podcast or if it was after the fact, but finding out that it was the same group of people who left BioWare during EA's sort of takeover of their team and Mass Effect 3 and everything like that. I just knowing like who it was who made the game was a really interesting fact and something that we don't, like, not a lot of people talk about, right? Yeah. So I've decided moving forward, I really wanted to try and dig into who it was making the games that we've been playing. So that's my research, is that this is an actual internal Sega game.
Cool.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that?
No, I don't think I've played any of the other games that the team has worked on, but
I haven't either. Skies of Arcadia is one that I own and is in my pile of shame, but I haven't played it yet.
I've heard good things, but yeah. I don't play enough JRPGs to add the ones that are obscure but mostly liked to my list.
Dreamcast games that got re-released as GameCube games?
Yeah.
I think those are worth going for. I'll play it eventually. My familiarity with Valkyria Chronicles is that I literally bought my PS3 in 2009 to play this game. It was one of the first really well reviewed Japanese games to come out in the HD era, and I had been looking for a reason to own a PS3 for quite some time at that point. And this was that game, and I remember loving it, so I was pretty excited to come back to it for this podcast.
I'm pretty sure I played it a little bit, I assume on the PS3. I just remember that I played a couple of missions. I remembered how the basic structure of playing mission worked, but I think what happened was that As happens with a number of games with me, I got to the point where you get to the HQ and it asks you to pick 20 people from a whole list, and I got overwhelmed with choice paralysis and said, I'll come back to this later, and I never did until now.
Yeah. I can kind of understand that. And you never played any of the other games in the series?
I figured I would, if I wanted to come back to the series, I'd play the original.
Sure. I did play Valkyria Chronicles 2 as well on the PSP. It's the only other in the series that I played, and it's VC2 is notable for being the only actual sequel. Every other Valkyria Chronicles game is really just a different story within the same time period of this Second European War. So I think, while notable that VC2 is a sequel, it has a lot of problems, and I don't think I will ever go back to replay that one.
Yeah, I looked up some of that up while deciding whether or not to get Valkyria Chronicles 4 while it was on sale, and it sounds like the 2 and 3 are just superfluous and not necessary since the timeline is all over the place.
3, I've been told, is really, really good as far as the story and characters and everything, but because it never got an actual U.S. release, I've just never gotten around to it because it would mean I'd have to get either an emulator or, I don't know, it just became hard at that point to play VC3. Also illegal, right? Well, I mean,
sure.
Technically, can it be illegal if they've never offered it to be sold here? Anyways. Yes. I am excited to play VC4 eventually. Reviews, I don't know, but should be very similar to this game, but they've added or changed a little bit. But a lot of people say that it plays or reminds them of VC1, so that's enough to keep me interested.
Yeah, I've heard it's more of a return to form.
Yep. Are you familiar at all with the Valkyria Revolution game that came out, I want to say, last year?
No, not at all.
Valkyria Revolution. So, again, the whole studio thing. Mm-hmm. VC2 and 3, because it's a PSP game, was not 100% developed by that same internal Sega studio. They actually got a studio, I want to say it was called Media Works or something like that. I could have wrote this down, but I didn't. But they actually did the bulk of the development for 2 and 3. With the original Sega team having some sort of advisory or some influence. But at one point, it was decided when, I would guess, Valkyria Chronicles, the remaster, did really well on PC, they started to greenlight other Valkyria projects, one of which was from that external studio saying, hey, we want to make a game that is in a alternate timeline / universe, but has some of the same themes and like visual styling, but also not the same combat system. And it's just a mess of a game that I will never play because it looks awful.
Cool. Well, now I kind of want to, but
it's more of an action RPG than a tactical RPG.
Ah.
If that makes sense.
Well, you know what they say, if it's not broke, then change what everybody liked about it.
Some companies do that. Sometimes, we'll eventually both play God of War.
Yes.
They changed a lot there, but I guess you could also claim that people were kind of upset with them after Ascension didn't change enough, or it did change too much of the multiplayer. I don't know. Anyways, there are some instances of changing is good. Yes. Sometimes. Pokemon, there you go. They changed something that people weren't really complaining about, and now everyone's saying it's great.
Yeah.
Who knows? We'll play those games eventually, once we get out of the 2008-09 era. Knowing what game we're going to suggest next, it's not likely. Yeah. Okay, so enough pre-ramble. Let's get into the meat of the story for Valkyria Chronicles, and that means we're going to be spoiling this game. And I guess I'll be reading the plot synopsis, right?
Yep.
So, spoiler warning again. This is the plot of Valkyria Chronicles. It is the year 1935 EC. The continent of Europa is dominated by two superpowers, the autocratic East European Imperial Alliance in the East, a stand-in for Russia and the like.
Yep.
At Germany. there's a lot of similes with the Second World War that'll become pretty... the real world Second World War. And then the Commonwealth of loosely allied democracies known as the Atlantic Federation in the West. The economies of both powers depend on a precious multi-purpose mineral called Ragnite. Its growing scarcity results in the Empire declaring war on the Federation, sparking the Second European War. The Empire uses its military superiority to quickly put the Federation on the defensive. Emboldened by their progress and momentum, the Empire decides to invade the neutral Principality of Gallia in order to seize its rich Ragnite deposits. When Imperial forces launch an attack on the Gallian border town of Brule, Welkin Gunther, the son of late Gallian national hero General, I don't know how to say that name, Belgen Gunther, is forced to fight for his life alongside the town watch captain Alicia Melchiot. Together with Welkin's adopted sister Isara, and using Belgen's prototype tank from the First War, the Edelweiss, they escape to Gallia's capital, Rangris, and subsequent join the country's militia forces. Well, wasn't Alicia already part of the militia? No, she was the town watch or something, right?
Yeah, I think she was the town watch. I think everyone just kind of got drafted.
Pretty much. Welkin is given the rank of lieutenant because he has a college education, I guess, and assumes command, and he also brought his own tank.
Yes, that helps a lot. Well, as I recall, every citizen had to take some military training, and his elective also happened to be tank operation, and his family had a tank. It all worked out, and he ended up a lieutenant.
And he assumes the command of the newly formed Squad 7, with Alicia acting as his non-commissioned officer. Initially, the members of the squad question Welkin's qualifications due to his lack of combat experience. However, he quickly earns their trust and loyalty with his tactical genius by driving his tank through a river.
Yeah, no one saw that coming.
Welkin and Alicia soon become romantically engaged throughout this their combats. After Squad 7 wages a successful campaign against the Imperial forces, the Crown Prince Maximilian deploys one of his commanders, Silveria Bless, equipped with the Ragnite lance and shield of the ancient Valkyrer race, thought to have saved the ancient world from the Darksome race. Using her innate powers, she decimates the Gallian army, and Alicia is shot by Welkin's archaeologist colleague, Valdio, in order to awaken her own latent Valkyria powers. I always find it weird that they switch between Valkyria and Valkyrer. I don't know.
Yeah, I tried to figure out, like, what the difference... I think... Valkyr was just the race overall, and Valkyrian was someone who had awakened, but I'm not sure they use that consistently. I was trying to figure that out.
Alicia is then able to drive Silveria back, allowing the Gallians to advance to the border. Silveria commits suicide in defense of the Gerlandio fortress, killing the self-serving Gallian commander and a large portion of the Gallian army, but sparing Squad 7, who is escorting the prisoners, Silveria's own troops, away from the fortress at the time. Maximilian, wanting to create his own empire, uses his ultimate weapon, a land dreadnought called the Mormota, to break through Gallia's defenses and steal a giant Valkyria lance from within the Rangri's castle. The princess then reveals herself to be Darkson. The Valkyrer rewrote history to make themselves into heroes, while an allied Darkson tribe gained Rangri's as the spoils with Alicia, With Alicia's help, Squad 7 is able to board the Mormorta, destroying its engine and defeating Maximilian. Alicia and Welkin are rescued, and they all return to Brule, where they marry and raise a child. The end. I kind of want you to go first as far as the chapter you would like to discuss. Do you have one?
Yes, I do. It's, well, more like one of the subplots that came to a head during Chapter 11, the battle at Marbury Shore, which is the relationship between Rosie, the shock trooper, and Izara, Welkin's sister, who is a Darkson, because I found it kind of off-putting at first, but I think that the story ended up paying off in a good way, because one of the things you're introduced to very early on in the game is that these Darksons are a race that is discriminated against, that is, especially in the, you know, evil Imperial forces. That's how you are introduced to Isara, is that she's trying to protect a friend, what was it, Martha?
Yeah.
And one of the Imperial soldiers keeps talking about how she's a smelly Darkson, he should shoot her right now. And
a dark hair.
Yeah, a dark hair. And, I mean, that's a pretty obvious analog to the real world, you know, discrimination against Jews that is, you know, comes up even more in later chapters. And so it was really off-putting when you first meet the rest of your squad, and at first they're like, ah, we don't trust this Welkin, who's, you know, too young to be commanding us. We're experienced veterans, or at least think we're too good for him. And I'm like, all right, that makes sense.
Some of them had participated in the first Europa
War. Largo yeah. is explicitly a veteran, and Rosie just sort of slides on Largo being veteran and that giving her credit being his friend. But so that made sense. But then they're also giving Isara crap and saying, like, I'm not gonna fight alongside a smelly Darkson. And that was a really off-putting way to introduce the squad for me. In fact, that was after you select your squad members, aside from the ones that are mandatory, and one of them, they all have personality attributes, and one of them, the attribute was hates Darksons, and I was like, all right, you're not on my squad. But the two mandatory members also feel that way. But through the story, they sort of come to appreciate Izara. I think Largo seems like he didn't care about it as much, but Rosie really went into that, you know, I'm not gonna fight alongside Darkson, and if I have to, I'm not gonna be happy about it. And you sort of find out why in one of the side stories, but in chapter 11, the battle on the beachhead, you succeed because of, well, first of all, before that, you have to liberate, there's a mission before that where you liberate a concentration camp, and it's obviously not quite as bad as real world concentration camps, but it's still a horrifying sight. And, you know, Rosie kind of realizes who she's thrown her lot in with when she complains about smelly dark hairs and all of that, and obviously regrets what she said, but she can't bring herself to admit it until the battle on the beachhead, after you are sent on a suicide mission and only survive because Isara created these incredibly useful smoke grenades. And just before Rosie is able to tell her, you know, thank you, or I'm sorry, or something to that effect, Izara is shot, and by a sniper, just when everybody thinks that they've won. And it's pretty surprising and emotional, and you end up getting Rosie's final ability, which is that she can, you know, increase her stats while she's near Darkson, because she wants to, you know, make up for the way that she treated Isara. And you also get her side mission, which is that there's a you find out there's a group of Imperials hunting Darkson to fill their labor camps again. And I think that's one where your leader, Captain Verat, says, oh, someone else is taking care of this. And Rosie goes, no, I want to do it. We should do this mission. And like I said, it was kind of an off-putting way to be introduced to your squad, but I think that I enjoyed that part of the story and the way it played out in the end.
Hmm. Yeah. It was an interesting choice to kill her off. I wasn't expecting that the first time I played through. But I don't know. I kind of also wanted to talk about a Darkson plot. There's a lot of Darkson plot to this game.
Part of the subplots and also the main plot. So
the one I wanted to talk about, the Darkson I wanted to talk about, which you don't know is a Darkson right away, is the Princess Cordelia.
Oh, I should probably say, since I don't know if I've mentioned on the... I think I have when we talked about Wolfenstein before, but I am Jewish, and yeah. So that's why that kind of plot is personal to me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that that's why that, especially with Rosie, was very affecting to me.
One thing I would definitely go back to what you said is the concentration camp scene where when the Imperials, who have collected the Darksons up as slave labor in this camp, when they lose that battle, as they retreat, they torch the camp with all the Darksons inside. And that is a really good scene to show how it sort of breaks
Rosie's
like her prejudice at that point, realizing that, hey, these were people.
Right.
And that really, I think that was done really well.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, the Darkson I wanted to talk about is the Princess Cordelia, who, because of wearing this completely crazy headdress, you don't see her hair.
Yep.
So you don't know. And her whole thing, like said in the plot synopsis, is that centuries ago, like it is described that the Valkyria race is so ancient at this point that most think it was a mythical sort of thing, like couldn't actually have existed. There's no actual records anymore. The lance and shield that Faldio steals from a museum for Alicia, they said were just relics. They didn't even have them attributed to the Valkyria race. Did you see these newspaper articles?
Yes.
Yeah. So like there's a lot in there that make it sound like this is basically a forgotten race at this point,
mm-hmm.
for most people. And yet you have this princess who, when she is, like, introduced, is introduced as the scion to the Valkyr.
Right.
Which, in every way that they present it, would lead me to believe that she is a descendant of the Valkyrian race.
The way I was kind of thinking of it would be if you were to say, oh, yeah, the current Queen of England is directly descended from King Arthur.
Oh, okay.
That's how I was kind of thinking of it, was like mythical figures that may have existed but probably didn't have actual magic powers.
Okay. But oh yeah, that is actually a very fitting comparison. And what also kind of threw me is the fact that she has the lance as her scepter.
Yes.
Like it is so weird that in the like mission or two before this is when you fight Silveria Bless as a like fully
awakened
Valkyria. And then you are introduced to this scion of the Valkyr as your princess. And so they have a whole family line, right? And it's just like, wait, we found out that they have these awesome powers. Why aren't we asking this princess to help us in this war? It's like that initial thought I had.
See, when we first met her, my thought was, which turned out to be, you know, ironic in retrospect, was, so wait, if the Darkson have dark hair, and then the one Valkyria we've seen has this, like,
silver-ish.
Bluish silver hair, like, is that what all of the Valkyrie have, or is that just because she awakened? What does the princess's hair look like? Now I want to know if she's a Valkyrie that doesn't have powers.
So that whole thing really threw me. But what, as, like I said, that sort of is like a pin on it. We'll come back to it later, because at the end of the game, when Maximilia stores the castle, it is then revealed, she reveals to him that, no, I am not part of the Valkyrian race, I am a Darkson. So having a kid with me would not produce any sort of superior heir, like he is promoting in that alliance takeover talk. And it just... I don't understand any of that, to be honest, of why they decided to have, like, there's that, the whole reason why her family's in state is because they betrayed the rest of the Darksons who originally lived in Gallia when the Valkyria showed up. And then they took on the guise of being Valkyrian themselves moving forward. Her, whatever you call it, bog, right?
Hmm?
Her prime minister.
Oh, yeah, Borg.
Borg. Does the exact same thing, but Maximilian then says, no, we're not going to trust you. Like, there's just so many things about that storyline that confuse me more than I feel actually help the plot line.
Yeah, it seemed like we already had this big twist about the history where we found out that, oh, the Valkyrie were the bad guys, but since they won the war, they rewrote the history to make the Darkson the bad guys, and I'm just not sure that we, like, having the twist with the princess, like, added to that. It seemed like they wanted a final chapter twist. And they just didn't really add much compared to what they'd already revealed.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a lot of issues with Cordelia. The entire second game being a post, like the only one that's actually a sequel, mm-hmm. taking place after these events, it entirely focuses in on the response to finding out that Gallia's response to finding out that their princess, their royal family, really, has been Darkson all along.
Right. That's another thing is I realize that there's a lot of fantasy elements in this, but the idea that this entire family line for generations and generations never let anybody see their hair.
Including the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister was just as surprised.
that seemed totally ridiculous.
Yeah, there's a lot. See, like, there's a lot to this game that I really like, how it sort of takes the real world elements of World War II and adapts them into this fantasy world where mm-hmm. it can sort of explore, especially, I mean, Japan being part of that Imperial Alliance. Mm-hmm. Like having them be part of that whole conversation of, or this is their fantasy version of it and how they want to explore that story.
Yeah.
Is an interesting idea. I just don't understand why they decided to include some of these elements that, if anything, like they don't add in any constructive way. And it just, I don't know. Trouble. I guess my chapter was just my feelings of being frustrated with the story than anything.
I didn't have a problem with the fantasy elements specifically, but I think there were definitely a number of story elements that felt like it was at odds with it being an analog to World War II, but they're just like, no, we want these particular sort of story elements and plot twists because
It's anime.
Because it's anime.
There was definitely a lot of that. Anything else you want to talk about as far as the story, or would you like to start getting into things that we liked about
this game? Yeah, let's get into things that we liked.
Okay, I'm going to start by saying I loved the combat system this game. There are so many tactics games that are about predetermined squares and percentage chances to hit, and this tactical game instead feels like a wonderful hybrid between a third-person shooter and a turn-based tactics game. You get to position your units, which still has a huge amount of importance based on, like, if you're approaching from the front or from the rear of the enemy, or if you're surrounding them. Like, there's still a lot of that tactical element to it. But now, unlike other, like, turn-based tactical games, you'll get shot at while you're approaching the enemy. So those real-time elements is really nice.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the game could have been done, like, theoretically could have been the same if you were just moving units around in a totally top-down view, but it really does feel very different when you are controlling the character directly, you know, trying to run in front of the enemy line to get to cover, or trying to sneak around without revealing yourself before you're out of their sight, and the way that you kind of get an overview, but when you're actually down at the character view and sneaking around, you can be surprised because there's someone that, you know, wasn't on your map just as you come around a corner, or maybe
or hiding in the grass
and you just, like, run into them and they immediately start shooting you. It's both a very different feeling than straight tactical games, and also adds more of an element of the unknown when you have to move step by step. You're not just pointing to a spot and saying, run here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not just saying, go to this square. You're actually controlling that character as you approach and positioning your characters of, like, okay, I've used up my movement. Which direction do I want to be facing for this next turn?
Yes,
or I want to try and hide in that grass? Like, do I want to maneuver myself over there instead so that if another enemy is trying to pass by me, I can then pop out and shoot them? Like, there's a lot of that sort of positional stuff that I really enjoy about this game.
Yes, that was one thing that I kept messing up in the first couple of missions until I got used to it, which was run out from behind cover till I could shoot someone and then run back and run out of movement and just end the turn. And I kept forgetting to, when I ran out of movement, make sure I had my unit face in a direction I wanted them to face, especially if they were going to be able to shoot at enemies coming in. But even if they couldn't, because it was a sniper or a lancer, just having them face the enemies allowed them to dodge.
Yeah, it would increase their chance to dodge. And there's also, if you position your troops next to allies and then fire, they'll then all combine their attacks, which is very important in some of the later missions.
Oh, yeah.
Another wonderful aspect I feel about the attacking portion of the combat is that when you go into that attack phase, the enemy stops shooting at you, giving you that chance to really aim to make sure you're getting the shot you want. There's also the fact that the reticules, instead of just giving you a percentage of your chance to hit, the reticule itself, the circles, sight lines, whatever, will actually show you the possible area that your shots will land in.
Yes, I think that was a good way to give you a visual that was easy to understand of how likely you are to hit without giving you, like, an exact number to obsess over, nudging it in, trying to get it up a few more percents, which I definitely have done with some tactical games. And
or lie to you. Like, have you ever played any of the XCOM games?
No, but I've heard about that a lot. because people see like an 80% chance to hit and think, oh, that's guaranteed, that they actually put it on a curve. So if it says 80%, it really means like 95%.
Yep.
Because if you miss one out of five times on an 80% chance to hit, you'll probably get mad and think the game is cheating, because that's how human brains work.
Yeah, but in this one, if I'm like trying to line up that shot and I see that, oh, I can only really get like that visually 50% of the target in the sight line, then that makes sense. And I can adjust it accordingly.
Yep.
It's like, okay, I can't, like, I've got too much empty space here when aiming at the head. I'll take a body shot, which I know will hit, sort of thing.
Right, or I don't know if this necessarily helped, but sometimes I would say, okay, I'm gonna line up so it's mostly on the body, but a little bit on the head, and maybe that will get some headshots. But if it doesn't, it won't actually miss.
Yep, and I really appreciated that. And then it also, because it just lets you pause for that moment of when you're aiming and you realize, hey, I can't hit what I want from this distance. You can then leave the attack phase, move a little bit more if you have the movement, and then go back into it. And if you do it fast enough, maybe you'll only get hit like one or two times instead of a full, like, because the enemy does take that moment to like re-aim and start firing mm-hmm. as you leave and move. Like there's a good timing to it. That
I don't think I ever tried that, but I definitely really did like panic, try to end the turn as quickly as possible after firing, because sometimes I would like run into enemy fire and hit the aim button and try to get off one shot before they could actually kill me. And then after you're done aiming, you could usually cancel the your turn
before they
start firing again, and then have someone else come and heal that unit or shoot the enemy and save them before. And occasionally I would then jump back into the same unit and try to open up the aim real quickly, but that usually didn't work. They'd get a couple hits in.
That was really dependent on situations. I did really enjoy all of the combat stuff. Then, like we mentioned before, that every unit has a weak spot that you can try to exploit for that critical damage.
Yes.
That's
one thing that a small point that I enjoyed was that all of the tanks have a big glowing blue radiator.
Yeah.
That just, at the moment you see one, it just screams, this is the weak point, shoot that. But I also noticed, just as a point of world building and design, every other vehicle in the game, even the ones that you can't shoot at, also have a big glowing blue radiator. So that's a consistent thing with Ragnite fuel technology, or at least vehicles, is that it's not just on the tanks that you have to shoot. It's also on, like, abandoned trucks that have been blown up, and it's on the train that you can't shoot at directly, and
it's in the car or whatever that they're trying to steal away Cordelia in.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I thought, which you technically can shoot, but you should not.
Not with a missile or anything.
Not, yeah. Don't blow up the weak point with a missile.
Or, yeah, whatever the, anything explosive in that mission. Yeah, I just, there really was a lot that I enjoyed about this concept on the combat system, and it's definitely a large reason why I loved and still love this game. So I loved it. How about you?
One aspect that, like I said, was initially overwhelming the first time I played it, but I ended up really enjoying, was how they have a bunch of very minor characters that they don't really have any plot to themselves, but all of the rest of your squad that you fill in have their own personalities. They have, I forget what the word was, qualities or something. It was, they'll have their own quirks that can give them a bonus or even a penalty in certain situations.
Yeah, like metal allergy or, like meadow bed bed bug or something? Or no.
Oh, bug in a rug.
But something. Or there's like some are lone wolves or born right. leaders or yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, one unit may be claustrophobic, which means they panic when they're in a trench. And another unit, it just says bug in a rug and says, oh, they feel really comfortable in small spaces. They get a bonus when they're in a trench.
One that I always got annoyed by was Chatty Cathy.
Yeah. That was one that I just ended up... That was one that I added to my squad and then ended up taking out of my yep. squad. And they also... Each person also has a list of up to three other people that they like. Some of them have specific bonuses, like Alicia has the unique maternal quality that is when she's standing next to one of the people that she likes, like Dallas the Engineer or, of course, Welkin, then she gets a bonus to all of her stats. And also, just when, as you were saying, when units are standing next to each other, they'll and fire, they'll both fire. And I believe it's said that they get a bonus, or maybe that's more likely to happen when they like each other, even if they don't have a special bonus for that. But it was kind of fun because you put... there's a huge list of candidates, and you put 20 people, including Alicia, Largo, Rosie, and I think Welkin also counted for the 20. But so another 16 people on your team, but you can only have, or on your squad, you can only deploy 8, not counting the tanks, at a time. So you basically filled your squad with, like... Oh, I'm only probably going to need like 1 or 2 scouts at a time, but I'll have alternates so that if I go to a desert, I can pick someone that doesn't have a desert allergy.
Sure.
And then deploying the squad sometimes turned into a little mini game of like, well, all right, it's a desert and it's going to have a lot of trenches. So, and I want to have at least 2 scouts. So I always have Alicia because she has great stats and she gives an extra action point. So the second scout can be Nancy, because Nancy likes being in trenches. And if I'm going to have Nancy, then I may as well have Dallas as the engineer on the same part of the squad, because Dallas likes Alicia and likes girls. So she should just be on the all-girl squad. So I'll also put Rosie in there. If I put Rosie there, then I can't have this other person here...
Who hates Rosie.
And... So I'll have Largo in the other squad so that Largo can be there and the person who hates Largo can be in the other squad. And I guess I won't put Cherry there because Cherry is friends with Nancy and Cherry is a Chatty Cathy and that will just lower all of their stats.
That's a really fun aspect in my opinion, yeah.
And it... A thing that I realized was initially annoying, but I realized was also kind of amusing, was most of them only have 2 of their 4 personal aspects unlocked, and then there's also some class aspects that unlock as you level up the different classes.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, I picked the ones that had no negatives, and what I realized was that as you unlock more of their qualities by using them in battles... Sometimes you unlock negatives, and all of a sudden this sniper, who I would put up in a tower where he can see everybody, is a coward, and his accuracy gets lowered when all of the enemies can see him. And he didn't realize he was a coward until several battles in.
That's pretty cool. I didn't run into any situations like that.
So my assumption is that, you know, that... The units that already have 1 negative quality only unlock positive ones, and that was the actual trade-off. But that was an amusing realization.
I definitely focused in a lot on the who likes who part of it, and then if, like you said, if there's a desert, then I would try to avoid the ones who have desert allergies, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part. Chasing those bonuses isn't all that important.
Yeah, they...
Not anywhere near as important as the type of unit and positioning it.
Well, the qualities also only manifest like a certain amount of time.
Yeah, they're a little random.
So even if you know this person, like, you know, Alicia doesn't get her maternal bonus every time she's standing
or next like to the healing one. Like, there's some who have they'll like give a bonus when they heal, but yes. Not every time.
Well, some of them have a certain thing that triggers it, and some of them it's just. Yeah. It just says in the description a set amount of time or a set number of times or a set percentage chance.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't tell you what those odds are. Although they're one of the orders you can get increases the chances that they'll activate, and even then it was like, okay, so it's from an unknown number to a higher unknown number. So I never used it. I will say though that I did try. I think the best example of planning around that was that. I had three different snipers, and there was a very small chance that I would ever need more than one sniper
in
a mission. But one of them...
Even with the fact that they only have the three shots per phase, round, whatever you want to say.
They start with three shots, and they can have a maximum of three shots, and each round they get one bullet back.
Somehow. So,
some of them also had the extra shot ability, which was nice when it
triggered. That was nice. Yeah, unit that had that of the Lancer, I enjoyed that.
My point being that I had one sniper that was a lone wolf and got penalties if she was around friendly units and got a bonus to evasion if she was all on her own. And then I had another sniper that was actually good buddies and got bonuses if he was near people. And then another one that... the first two had the Nest Master, which sometimes gave them a bonus if they were up high. And the last one that I had... I forget the name, but he got a bonus if he was shooting at someone else higher. So based on the map, I could choose which one of those to bring based on where my one sniper was going to be. If I was going to have them, like, climb up into a nest away from everyone else, I would send the lone wolf. If I thought they were going to be, you know, advancing with the group, but also...
I don't know, with that movement speed, how did you do that?
There were some maps where I had to move slowly just to sweep with the shock troopers. Other times it was a matter of climb up a ladder, shoot some things, climb down the ladder, go to the base and retreat, and then redeploy at a further base.
That is definitely a unique thing to this game, is the whole being able to retreat in a base and then the reinforcements from another base further along in the map.
Yeah, I used that a lot with the snipers, and sometimes with the lancers as well, when I realized, deploy some lancers at the start of the battle, realize there are no tanks around, so I don't move them forward, and then much further there are tanks. So I used the, once I got it, my most used order was the retreat order, which just saved me the trouble of using one action point to have someone run to...
Well, the order was still...
That's what I mean. It was the same number of actions, but I could do that when they weren't standing next to a flag.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, that was an interesting aspect, and I used that a lot for snipers and lancers, that lancers could move further, but if I wasn't bothering to move them, that was easier.
Yeah. There were some maps that I definitely... wish I had known more about before doing the whole positioning your units, but I'll get into that in the things I didn't like, I guess. One thing that I do want to mention that I really liked about this game, and it's mostly influenced because I did play VC2, and so VC2 being a PSP game, their storage and memory or whatever was a lot smaller, so they actually, the maps were all of a smaller size, or they were segmented into different parts. Mm-hmm. Like, you'd have to go through loading screens to get to other parts of the map. And then also you repeated them a lot, which sucked in my opinion. And I didn't realize until replaying this game how great it is that there are of the... I didn't count how many total maps there are, but there you only repeat two maps in the entire game. And even of those two repeated maps, they are different, and you are doing different things on them. Like the when you return to Brühl,
yeah,
and when you return to the bridge,
yes,
retake the bridge. Both of those are technically maps that you've done before, but that you are approaching them in such different ways that they feel like new maps, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. It has to be over 20 maps, because there's 18 chapters, and several of them you... Well, yeah. 18 plus the side chapters.
So...
And many of them you have multiple battles.
I just really want to point out how great I think it is that this game has so many different maps with different objectives. Even though, like, most of them is just capture the enemy base, but I would say, like, half of them are capture the enemy base.
Yeah, a lot of the side chapters had interesting
yeah.
alternate objectives, but most of the main ones were capturing the enemy base, which is fine, because that's what you learn how to do.
Yep. Which meant that most of my strategy was actually heavy scout.
Yes.
You mentioned that we only really need like two scouts. I was like, oh man, I never deployed without at least four scouts.
See, my strategy in those cases was often to have at least in some of the open maps, it would be to have a sniper or some shock troopers, like, just punch a hole in the defenses and then have Alicia run through that hole and claim the enemy base. In fact, one of the side missions where you... it's like a spiral hill where there's a bunch of...
Yes.
You have to...
I know that one.
Either advance up the spirals on the sides or climb up ladders at a few points. So, after trying a couple of approaches that would, like, get someone killed and restarting, I tried just having Alicia run up to the closest ladder and then climb up and then run around some soldiers and climb up another ladder, and she ended up on top. And then I threw a grenade at the three soldiers in the base, and they didn't die, but they got knocked out of the base, so I claimed it. And won.
There it is. Yeah, a lot of the A ranks, if you want to go for them, the easiest way to get them, especially for the like the capture of the base, is to just punch that hole and run a scout through.
Yeah.
If you even need to punch a hole. But yeah, definitely. That is definitely one way where the game can kind of break. Is just, yeah. But it's still enjoyable figuring that out, in my mm-hmm. opinion.
Yeah, I agree. It didn't feel like it made the game... It probably... I think it threw off the game balance. In particular, when I beat... I didn't realize at the time that they were missions from the DLC that was just included in the Switch version. But the class-specific challenges... The first one, the Scout Challenge, gives you an amazing rifle for the Scouts, and I gave it to Alicia, and that felt like it threw off the balance, but it was still pretty fun figuring out how to exploit that, because I'm pretty sure your Scout is not... You're not supposed to have one Scout be able to take out a shock trooper behind cover in a single round of fire.
No, that definitely should not have been happening.
A lot of my strategy in the second half of the game revolved around that.
That's funny. And that's also something maybe worth mentioning, is that in this game, like, I think it's impossible to get a 100% completion on your first run through. Like, the game is built, in my opinion, around the idea of replaying it, especially since I don't know if this is true of the remaster, but I played the original PS3 version again because I already owned it, and I felt bad spending $20 on a game I already owned.
Fair enough.
Everything I read was that it didn't really add or change anything other than running on a newer system.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say was that... So you could go after the A rankings, which is entirely focused around the number of turns it takes to complete the mission. Mm-hmm. But there are also things of like going after the enemy aces who will drop a unique weapon.
Yes.
And if you want to get 100% in this game, you have to collect all of those weapons.
Yeah,
I think stuff like that.
I probably missed some of those, but it was the... After a while, I noticed that, except for some of the scout rifles, the weapons I was getting from the Imperials, from those aces, tended to be shorter range and more powerful, which was not what I wanted in a lot of cases, especially like the snipers and the lancers. I totally focused on increasing their accuracy because my strategy for them was 100% get behind the tank and shoot the weak point, and I want you to be accurate when you're shooting at the weak point.
Yes. Yes, that is true. One thing I experienced with... So I completed the main game, and then I decided to play through some of the DLC, and this was specifically for the Behind Her Blue Flame, the Silveria Bless DLC. Is that you sort of restart using, it's the beginning of the game again kind of stats, with Imperial units and, armaments. So that aiming reticule, which I, at the end of the game, was really nice and tight and effective, all of a sudden I'm playing this DLC and it's like this giant circle again, and I'm like, I can't do anything!
Oh, man, I can't. Toward the end of the game, I took a screenshot on my Switch of one of the snipers using the best sniper rifle when his sometimes accuracy boost happened, and it was like I could be looking at an Imperial soldier that was 100 yards away, and it was just focused right in on the pupil of his eye. I was like, I wonder if I'll hit.
That's a good example of another way you can kind of cheese the game is one of the harder missions is the one where you're storming the defensive fortress to get to Silverius.
Yes.
You can just snipe her.
Huh. I didn't try that because they told me, oh, she'll probably... Well, when I did eventually get close and tried to attack her, she kept evading everything unless I was directly behind her. So I just assumed that was what was going to happen if I tried to snipe her. Especially since I had a lot of other annoying instances of someone, barely within visual range going, oh, there's a sniper shooting at me, I should duck.
Yeah.
But... that one was frustrating until I remembered, oh yeah, I still have the smoke grenades.
No, those smoke grenades are a lifesaver in the later missions.
Yes.
I did the same thing. I think I was I had gotten my troops somehow up the staircase, but it was then trying to get them from that across the completely open area to the elevator or whatever. Mm-hmm. That was where I started to lose them. I was like, how do I get by this? Oh, smoke grenade. yeah. It's such a good game. Anything else you want to mention as far as a like?
I think that covers it for me.
Okay. Dislikes, then. My big dislike, again, I was playing on the PS3 version, and I know that the newer versions are a little bit better on this. But some of it is just unavoidable. It's just the amount of waiting in this game.
Yes.
Between the load times for everything, including the different little story segments in each chapter, where it'll load the cinematic or text-based story bit, then load back the book, so that you can choose the next story segment to load. Like, there's so much loading and waiting. The other part is, and some of it is skippable, but a lot of it isn't. And then another part that I felt like I was always waiting on was the enemy moves.
Yes, that was the big one for me.
I really, there were times, especially at the point when, like, you can't even see any of their soldiers, and it's just saying moving or whatever.
Shuffle, shuffle.
Shuffle, shuffle.
Shuffle, shuffle. Shuffle, shuffle.
It's like, why am I waiting for this?
I'm going to bring this up a lot, like I already have, because it was one of the early missions that I kept going to over and over, but the scout challenge from the DLC missions, that was a nightmare of every time you took a turn, you had to wait for 8 people to shuffle around the map where you couldn't see them.
Because the AI, a lot of the AI routine was, okay, you're hidden, or whatever, you're behind a corner, run out of that corner, if you see anything, shoot, if not, run back.
Right.
And you had to wait for that every time.
Yeah, there was, it was a DS game that I tried the demo but never played the game. Codename Steam has a similar system where it's turn-based but you control the characters directly. And they at least had a fast-forward button. You still couldn't skip. And honestly, it still took a while even fast-forwarding, but you could fast-forward through the enemy movement.
That would have been nice.
It was actually worse than this because they didn't have an overall map. So when enemies were moving off-screen, it would just be your camera sitting behind the character waiting, unless someone suddenly ran on-screen, it would turn to focus on them. And then they would run behind something, and you'd just be waiting again. But I still think the fast-forward button was a good idea.
How about something on your end?
So, I feel like there was too much weapon micromanagement, because you could get the Imperial weapons from killing the enemy aces. And in about the second half of the game, you could get awarded like 2 or 3 of a particularly good weapon from the princess.
Yep.
And that was on top of your base weapon being upgraded along, and eventually upgraded along different paths at the R&D center. And so you would have like 5 shock troopers and be able to load out each one of them with a different machine gun, or have them all use the default and one person uses a special gun. And on the one hand, it did lead to some interesting specialization. I had one shock trooper who had another like ridiculously powerful gun, but only operated at like point blank range from one of the Imperial aces. And so I was like, okay, if I'm fighting in a city or somewhere where there are very short distances when you turn around a corner and have to shoot someone, I'm going to give it to this one shock trooper. She'll be perfect for those situations, but not for, you know, big open deserts where you have to, you know, where people can shoot you for 10 minutes while you're approaching them. Other than that, though, it felt like it was a lot of busy work trying to keep track of which guns I had that were better than which other ones, and it would sometimes tell me, oh, you got the ZM-SGR, and I'd be like, cool, who does that go to? Whose gun is that?
Yeah.
Is that another copy of a gun I already have and like, or is it a new one that I have to go and compare? Well, first step is to check all of my units' equipment to see which one has a new next to it. And it wouldn't have been such a problem, except that it really could make a huge difference in situations where instead of 2 shots, it takes 1 shot. Or having a slightly longer range means that you can shoot enemies and they can't counter fire. So
yeah,
it really felt like it was too much micromanagement, or at least it was more than it really needed to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely understand all that.
Like, for comparison, the personality quirks were interesting, but they didn't actually feel as important as they could have. Like, they were not, they didn't feel so important that if I chose the wrong person, it would ruin the mission.
But the wrong weapon could definitely. Because you're like, oh, this is a shock trooper. I want to do this with that shock trooper. And then you go to that Amy reticle and it's like, wait, this is not what I was expecting.
Right. And it's like, oh, wait, I'm at a distance where, you know, all of the enemies can shoot me, but I forgot this is the one that only works at point blank. So they're 10 feet away and my gun will do no damage.
Yeah. That is definitely a weird thing. If you are just even slightly out of range, but you can still, like, the Amy reticle is still it saying, I will hit, but the damage is just 1 HP per yes. hit instead of its normal, like, 20 or whatever.
Yes, that was... I can see why they did that, but it was annoying.
Yeah, like, you're only getting chip and shots at that point, even though...
I think that... Here's another dislike. The line of sight lines that appear over you when you're running around...
Yeah.
Keep changing color, and it was never explained what the different colors mean. I think those are supposed to tell you if they're range.
They didn't explain that in-game. Yes, yeah, so each color can represent the distance, and if when you are able to fire at them and when they are able to fire at you.
Okay, that's what I thought, but it was hard. It was really hard to figure that out. And, I mean, I mostly just figured out, okay, if it's green, I'm 80% sure that means that I can hit them. But then it's if it's a different color, that either means I'm out of range or it means I'm in range, but they can also hit me. That was... I feel like that could have given me a lot of information that I needed, but it was not explained to me how.
That's fair. You're right. I don't... think they actually explained the sight lines in the game.
There was a pop-up that told you they are sight lines to enemies, but didn't tell you anything about the colors.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I don't think they explained that in game. Well.
Was it, I don't know, in a manual somewhere?
Maybe. Let's find out. I have the PlayStation 3 copy right here. So...
Honestly, who reads game manuals? Page 12, these days?
Maybe. All about the battles. Command mode. Squad list. Potentials and orders.
Potentials, that's the word.
Camera actions. Sight lines. Blue enemy is sighted, but still unnoticed by enemy. Yellow, identified by enemy, but out of range for interception. Red, identified by enemy and also within range for interception. Green, same as red, but enemy is reloading weapon.
So, my interpretation was completely wrong. Good to know.
Look at how useful manuals are. It's great that the gaming industry has gotten rid of that in the last generation.
It's good to know that the one thing I thought I had figured out was incorrect.
Okay, so... that was a fun little aside. Something I wanted to bring up as a dislike was the mission briefings.
Yeah, definitely.
The mission briefings, in my opinion, are not good. Like, at all. They never show you the full picture of the camps that are going to be in that area. Like, the map you see during the initial briefing is super vague.
It basically tells you where your starting point is and where your end goal is and nothing else.
Pretty much. And based off of that information, you then have to decide what units you're going to deploy in there. How many, if there is, like, there are some, like, the Cordelia mission where there, I think there's, like, 5 camps or something like that you can deploy your units to.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't even know what's going to happen, right? I don't know anything, but there's now all of these options, and, They don't show you a good terrain like that spiral. Like I could see that there was some sort of spiralness, but I didn't realize that it was like that kind of height through that initial briefing map.
Yep.
Or like valleys. Like there's a lot of that where there's just not enough detail in that briefing map for me to make educated decisions. And what I really hated about it is that I'm supposed to determine all of this starting information, start the mission, and if during that first round or two I find out that I completely misjudged this and I get like wiped for whatever reason, my options at that point are to reload a save or retry the battle. Retry the battle does not actually send you back to that initial
Oh,
positioning
that's
units.
interesting. In the remastered version I was playing, there's an option called briefing, which goes back to the briefing and lets you change your deployment.
I don't remember that button.
That may have been new.
Maybe? Or maybe I just completely missed
I feel like you
that.
probably would have noticed that if you were looking for specifically.
I want to say it was the other option was main menu.
Yeah,
I
for me
don't think
it was load, retry, briefing, or main menu.
there was a briefing. Maybe there was. Maybe I
Mean that it would make
huh.
sense that would be something they would add in the remake because
But
I use that a lot.
I had that problem a lot of oh I completely or I realized like the I, it lucked out. The Cordelia mission, I made it to like turn six or something like that, and then realized, oh, actually, if I didn't move Welkin, they would move right there, and I can position all of my units to just be waiting in ambush right there. And then I restarted that mission and was able to do exactly that, where I killed them on the second turn. Well, didn't kill, but you know, I
Yeah.
disabled the vehicle on the second turn because I knew I was the AI is pretty straightforward. I was able to go, okay, I know exactly where he's going, position all my units there, which I just barely on movement lucked out on being able to move them. Like I had Alicia as the farthest one away, so she was thankfully able to run to that position anyways. Like I lucked out, but it was still like I really wish I could have just gone back to the briefing and gone, okay, I need these units here, and now I know I can get this instead of just making it work with what I had previously deployed with.
Yeah, there were a lot of missions where I was like, okay, I guess I will guesstimate how many of each unit to deploy and then start the actual mission. And as soon as I looked at the, before I made any movement, as soon as I looked at the command mode map, said, oh, I did this all wrong. And sometimes I wouldn't, because I always saved before I started a mission, and sometimes I just go, oh, okay, and immediately quit, go back to the briefing, and deploy differently. Or in some cases, eventually when I started a mission, I would just deploy less troops so that I could then figure out if, after the fact if I needed, lancers or snipers. And I really wish that they had just given me like the start of battle information before deploying, especially when it came to snipers. And where, like, oh, there are two places to deploy. One of them, it turns out, has a sniper nest right next to it. And if you start the sniper at the other place, there's no point in having them run all the way there.
Yeah, I don't think I'm looking through the menu or the manual again, and I don't see any options. It doesn't describe what happens if you get a game
It
over.
really feels like that's something that they added in the remastered version
Could
because it was
be.
a complaint.
I will look that up later. One last thing that I wanted to mark as a dislike was just the final two to the final two missions of the final chapter. I feel both of those missions did not play to the strength of this game.
I agree. I thought they were interesting and unique, but they also felt like I wasn't really, like, a lot of my tactics that I had learned so far were useless.
Yeah, especially the Maximilian fight where he is such a a bullet sponge.
Absolutely. That was the one where I think you were suggesting this earlier as well. That was the one where I had to finally remember that, oh, if I just have my units stand next to each other and have one fire, then they'll all fire, because that was the only way to
do any decent damage.
Any damage to him, then he wouldn't be able to regenerate on his turn.
Yeah, there was that, and then the mission right before that is destroying the lance on top of the
Marmota.
The land tank, not land tank, but the land battleship.
Dreadnought.
Dreadnought, yes.
The Marmota.
The Marmota. The problem I had with that one is that the giant lance is really easy to hit, but is only vulnerable on the glowing bit.
Yeah, that took me a while to realize that if you aimed at... There were at least three different sections, because when I had... when I had my Lancer's aim at the main part, it was like 74 hits to destroy it. When I had my Lancer standing on top of the Marmota trying to point at the glowing tip, it was like 24 hits to destroy it. And then when I finally moved my tank, the Edelweiss, to the specific position where it told you...
I could not find that position. I couldn't find it. I could not find that position.
Yeah, well, first I tried pointing it at just the glowy part, and it was still like, you know, a dozen or a couple dozen hits. When I got it into just the right position where I could aim so high up, I thought the description made it sound like there was a hill that you could run it on, but it was actually in the treadmarks. There are dips in the tracks where if you back up your tank so the bottom is inside the dip, the tank lifts up just enough that you can hit. I actually had to move it not in the first dip, but further back into the second one so that it could actually hit the very tip. And at that point, it was like hit the tip of the lance three or four times.
Hmm.
And if I hadn't found that, I would have gotten much more frustrated because of just shooting lots and lots of rockets.
That was one where I reloaded so that I could throw in four Lancers into the mission, because my original plan was just two, because that's usually more than enough. But I was like, no, I'm going to have four Lancers with an engineer who will restock all of their ammo, and they will all go up the Marmota's, like, whatever, gangplank, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And they will just, in turn, all fire at that thing. And I took it down in like two or so turns by just spamming it. But that really, I don't know, that didn't play as well as the mission before it of taking out Jaeger and his tank.
That felt much more like a apex of what you've been doing so far.
Yep. Yeah, I feel like that was an appropriate final mission. Compared to what we actually got.
Actually, I had looked up how many chapters it was, because I like to know how far I am into a game. And so I knew it was be 18 chapters. When I finished the Captain Jaeger mission, I got to chapter 18. Because when you open a new chapter, it shows you the thumbnails in sort of sepia tone for each page, each whatever you call it, not each page, each photo, each scene, there we go. And none of them were a tactical map, so I thought, oh, was that the last mission? I guess I was expecting something more, but that kind of makes sense, because the chapter 18 just has a whole bunch of cutscenes, and then you actually go to another page that's still the same chapter that has the two final battles. So I was almost expecting there to be no battles in the final chapter, but
That would have been interesting. And probably better. That probably a better game. But it's already such a good game. Is there anything else that you would say as a dislike before we move on to those, like... Well, next we would normally talk about, like, particularly noteworthy moments.
Yeah, but... I think my main ones were actually covered by you talking about the having to wait for enemy movement and not having enough information while deploying. Sort of tangentially related to not having enough information while deploying. The one and only screen where you could look at someone's list of potentials and not actually see the definition of what those potentials did was when you were deploying, which was also the point where you most wanted to know what they did because you were deciding which ones to bring.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would look at it like, isophobia? What? Okay, I hope that doesn't have any effect on the mission I'm sending you on, because I don't...
Well, that one—I don't even know if I saw that one.
Well, that one I do remember because it was fear of pointy things, and it was they get a penalty when they're standing near lancers.
But there
were some that
that's funny.
Like I could get the gist of it from the name, but I didn't remember what it actually did. Like Lone Wolf, I don't remember what was penalized when she was standing next to people. If it's her defense, well, I don't care if she's a sniper. She's screwed if someone shoots at her anyway. If it's her accuracy, no, absolutely not. That I don't want to fall ever. And so that was another thing that I wish they had just given you that information while deploying, because that's the time you want to know it. That's my last rant.
Okay. So I have both a frustration... and a achievement to list as far as the noteworthy stuff. So I will do a frustration first.
All right.
Then you can go, and then I can go.
Yep.
So my frustration is that in the earlier part of this game, they did several twists halfway through the mission, which I found as just very frustrating. The main one... Like, I list a couple examples of, like, the Jaeger fight in Chapter 5, where his tank just appears when you get to that, when you get to a certain point in the mission.
I think I always came in from the side, so I didn't realize it just appeared. I just assumed that you got a cutscene when you got there.
Oh.
Like, I mean, I didn't come in a way that I could see it wasn't there.
Okay. And then the other is, the big one was the Severia fight in Chapter 7.
Yeah.
Where she, that is again, you destroy two of the three radiators, I think is her cue to show up. Or it may even be just a specific turn count that she shows up. And then she will run down... the center of this just happened to be the first time I'm playing. I had almost all of my units in her direct path.
Yes, that nice convenient trench in the middle of the map.
And she just ran down it and basically destroyed me in that one turn. And I was like, what could I have done other than be like a precog and know that this was going to happen?
It wasn't that devastating for me, but she knocked out one of my shock troopers that was in that trench, and so I was like, okay, well, now she's on the other end of that trench, so I'll just send one of my scouts to go save that shock trooper. Nope, she killed the scout. Okay, well, I'm going to come around the side, and I'm going to be really quick at... Nope, that's an engineer dead.
Yeah. No, that killed me. And that was one where I got really frustrated with it, because I had to... I wasn't keeping, like, a save scum sort of... save system at that point, where I could just go back a single turn. I had to go back to the beginning of that battle
Yeah.
And that just was really annoying.
Actually, I will say I had a similar frustration, which was the battle after... Well, is the battle after Alicia awakens, and they start with her just in the middle of the battlefield, and you have to capture the enemy base.
That one, the very first thing I did was take a scout, run mm-hmm. around her, and capture that enemy base. So literally the first, like, action was completing right. that mission. And then it yeah. was the pincer attack, and that pincer attack yeah. was my one time where I lost a unit, where a unit actually died on me. Well, the Vice, I think his name was.
Hmm.
The guy with the eye patch.
I don't think I had him on my team.
Oh.
And apparently that was good for him.
I got a little medal out of it for having a fully upgraded soldier fall in battle or whatever.
Well, I hope you will enjoy your medal. Because he won't.
He won't.
Also, that's kind of messed up that they give you a medal for that.
Like I said, I don't think you can complete this game in a single playthrough to get, like, everything. Mm-hmm.
But so I had moved my units up a little bit more before the pincer attack, but most of them were still at the beginning, and that was frustrating, first of all, because unlike a lot of other missions, you did not have a base at the beginning, so I couldn't say, oh, these units aren't helpful where they are, and it will take several turns to move them up, I'll just send them back. I don't think I even had the retreat order yet at that time. But the other thing was, I had a dedicated strategy of taking out the units that were most dangerous to me. So, like, if there were, you know, if I had to move my tanks up, I would take out Lancers. If there were any snipers at all, especially if I wasn't around cover, I would take out the snipers. But because they had continuous waves of enemies coming in from the south, and to a lesser degree from the north, every turn, I would take out their Lancers and Snipers on the south while I was trying to move my tanks towards safety. And then every turn, a new Sniper and two new Lancers, or maybe it was just one, I think it was Sniper, Lancer, and two Shock Troopers, would appear and immediately be able to take their turn and start shooting at my tank and sniping my people that were not at undercover. And that was really frustrating because there was no defense for that until I had made the whole trek halfway across the map. Well, to cover that had mostly been destroyed by the other attacks already. Mm-hmm. And that was... That just felt unfair, the fact that I could not prevent them from sniping every turn because they just brought in a fresh sniper every turn.
That one, I had gotten pretty used to the idea of always having at least two units that I didn't deploy at the beginning of the match so that I could immediately call for reinforcements.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have a reinforcement sniper come in to take care of the two snipers that are up there. But that really was a bad mission because to take out that tank on the north end, I had to move a tank all the way up and around, wow. And that just took forever. For me, because I couldn't get any of my Lancers up there, because, well, their movement also sucks, but they were also, they kept getting taken out by other enemy units before I could.
I was able to successfully get a couple of Lancers over there, and then in addition to them, I didn't get the tanks all the way there, but I got the Shamrock, the smaller light tank, to the base in the middle, and he could then fire at the tank from there.
My Shamrock got killed in that battle quickly.
It wasn't the Shamrock, because I sacrificed the Shamrock immediately to take out the one on the south. As soon as the pincer attack appeared, I had the Shamrock just drive behind that tank and shoot at its weak spot, and then said,
"But those reoccurring Lancers killed it."
I was surprised that he lasted another turn after that, but not a second. But it was just like, "You did your job. Enjoy all of those Lancers now."
My final achievement that I wanted to talk about was something I did in a mission that really shouldn't have worked out, but it did. It was the Marbury Shore mission. Mm-hmm. Halfway through the mission, you make it to the North Camp, and then you turn around to start entering the second choke point. Familiar with what I'm saying? Yeah. But as you enter that downhill slope is another bunker. Except this bunker, you can't just, like the first bunker, like go right to the explosive barrel behind it.
You have to get past the bunker before you can get behind it.
Yes. So I had, at this point, 4 units. 3 scouts and 2 shock troopers. Wait, what did I say? 3 scouts, 1 shock trooper who was Rosie, of course. Basically, what ended up happening is that my first scout, I just tried to run across really fast, I was thinking, and she got shot down, failed. I think it was like Freysia or something like that. I was like, okay, that didn't work. So I then was like, okay, I'll try to send in Rosie because she has the better armor. Maybe she can make it. Except I didn't notice that there was a grenade, or not grenade, a landmine along that path. And of course, I was just running. I wasn't paying attention. So it went click, click, and then boom, and she's down. So then I was like, well, shit. I need to get Rosie back. So then I tried to send in Alicia, I think it was, to grab Rosie so that with medic. Except she then got shot down trying to do that. So I've got this 3 bodies now out there and 1 scout left and 1 CP remaining for this round. I was like, I'm going to do this. So and previously I had already taken out all of the ground units, because I had stationed both of my tanks at this point up on that cliff, and they were able to take out everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to worry about any interception fire except for from that bunker. And so this last scout, I had her hug the wall as closely as possible so that she didn't get too many interception fire, and then sprint, like, while standing at the bunker itself, just sprint right across that window, and somehow she made it.
Nice.
So then she was able to shoot the explosive barrel behind the bunker, collect all 3 people who had fallen, and make it just to that next camp to grab its to claim it. Oh, I must have had more than 1 CP, because then I called for reinforcements so that the next turn I had a sizable team right there so that I could move on. But it was just this moment of, like, I should not have been able to pull that off, and I somehow did, just because it all worked out in the end. That's nice. I was like, that feeling of, oh my god, I can't believe this worked out.
Yeah, I think the way I handled that was I did get my tanks up on the cliff, and then I just dropped another smoke bomb in front of that so I could run around it.
Should have?
Probably.
But it was one of those things of, oh, I can definitely just get in front of it without having to waste the 2 CP to...
Ah, of course.
And then once I had started getting myself into that, I kept trying to dig myself out without doing the proper thing of using course. Another smoke grenade.
That's pretty great. So, my big achievement was, as I've mentioned, the scout challenge, because as soon as they suggested skirmishes, I went and found that.
Sure.
And because it's, even though it was originally DLC, it's included with the remastered version, and it's unlocked as soon as you unlock skirmishes. And I tried it, and I tried it several times, because I just assumed, oh, this is there's 2 lists of skirmishes, and this is the first thing in the second list, so I should do that first. Well, after beating the first skirmish in the first list, which is actually an easy thing.
Yes. Oh, yes, that one was just very easy.
Let's just replay the opening mission, but with a full squad.
With a full squad and, like, snipers and stuff.
Yeah. So, it turns out the scout challenge was not the same difficulty, and in particular, I also didn't realize at the time that all of those challenges were remixes of maps from the main story, so I hadn't even seen that map.
Oh, okay.
I didn't. So I was like, oh, here's a shortcut that I could use to get around this area. Oh, the shortcut has an enemy named Oswald the Gold that can kill everyone immediately. And after several tries to get that, I gave up, and I kept coming back. Like, every time I had done a couple of missions, I would come back with higher-leveled troops and better equipment and try to beat it again. I think it was after Chapter 7 or 8 when I finally did it by... I had also assumed that you were just supposed to use scouts, but I realized that... And I figured, oh, well, that makes sense because it's a really big map with lots of grass, and scouts are able to cover a lot of ground and see people in grass from a distance. And what I ended up doing instead was just having my one scout, Alicia, and then Rosie and another shock trooper, who was Jane, who was the one I had given the incredibly powerful point-blank machine gun to. So my entire strategy involved moving these two shock troopers slowly to the back end of the map so that I could have one of them... Well, I think I also figured out that I could throw a grenade just so that it would... Because where he was standing, the walls sloped because it was a natural environment. You could throw a grenade so it would land next to him without him having line of sight to you. So I could throw a grenade at him and get him to turn around, and then have a shock trooper run up behind him and shoot him in the head a bunch of times, which would take out some of his health, but he would still survive, and he would turn around and shoot them and knock them out. And then I would have the other shock trooper run up behind him again and shoot him in the back of the head again, and that finally took him out. And that was how I got my amazing overpowered scout rifle that Alicia used the rest of the game.
Gotcha.
And that, the fact that it was one that I kept trying over and over until I got it, made it very satisfying, and especially that it then broke the rest of the game. That I could have, like, the second, was it the second or maybe the first, I think it was the first big battle at the desert in Nagyar, where it's just a huge map.
Yes.
And
then there's the sandstorm in the middle. That one?
No. Yeah. There's I don't think it was the one with the sandstorm in the middle, because I remember there was a lot of me advancing slowly until I got to the base in the middle. There's a lot of trenches in the first half, and then you can capture the enemy base, and then really wide area with a few trenches and several tanks, several shock troopers, and a sniper.
Yeah, I think that's the one that there's then a sandstorm or something.
Okay.
In the middle of that map, which can help you cross without getting hit by the tanks.
Maybe. But what I did was I set up a sniper on top of the camp, shot... this was the one where I realized I could just punch a hole, which was just shot the people in the middle and had Alicia run straight down, and she could cross the whole thing in two actions. And when she got to the other end, there was a shock trooper that was at the base that never stood up, so I couldn't one-shot him with the sniper. But when Alicia got there, she could just shoot him while he was still behind cover and take him out in one round of fire.
Wow.
And then I captured the base and won. And so that was, like I said, just broke the game a bit.
Yeah.
And that... So that was my big achievement, was earning my super weapon for Alicia. In fact, I associated that with Alicia so much that then in the missions where she wasn't available, I didn't bother switching it to someone else. I was like, I'm sure I'll get her back.
Yeah. So for this final segment, we're going to be talking about our final thoughts on the game. And my daughter's now in the room, so we'll see how that turns out for us.
So, what are your final thoughts on the game?
I still love this game. And I was really happy that you decided to suggest it as one of our games. It's a game that I really soured. Bless you. I had soured on the series, I realized, because of Valkyria Chronicles 2. Which, it has its own good things. It does, like, the conversations and the giving you more story of your entire squad. It does that better than VC1. But the maps and the combat itself suffer so much in VC2 that was sort of how I remembered VC1 as well. I remembered the maps being like smaller, or I didn't remember how unique everything was and how much fun it was to master these gameplay elements and just to go through that adventure. So I really did enjoy my time going through this again.
And so did she.
And Eleanor did as well. Yeah.
So, I agree. I love this game. This is the kind of game that makes me, like, really glad that we're doing this podcast, and I can go back and play games that I kind of knew I would probably enjoy, but never made enough time for, and it was a blast, and I'm really glad that I finally played it.
Yeah, I think that covers our thoughts on Valkyria Chronicles. What game are we playing next week?
We're going to be playing...
Or next week. Next month. December.
Next, however long until Kingdom Hearts 3 comes out.
No, it'll be before that.
Okay.
I'm sure.
We're going to be playing... Actually, that's a good question we didn't discuss. Should we be playing the Spyro Reignited Trilogy or just the first game?
Oh, just the first game,
okay.
Was my thought.
Yeah,
yeah,
that
not,
makes sense.
I wasn't planning to try and do all three games as part of that.
But yes, Spyro the Dragon, the first game in the Spyro Reignited Trilogy, which is a game that a lot of people consider, you know, fundamental to their gaming experiences, that I've never played any Spyro game.
I haven't either. Not owning a PlayStation meant that I missed out on a lot of those classics.
Yes, me too.
While I have sort of dabbled in some of the Bandicoot games and realized that those were not for me, the Spyro games I have been interested in playing, and then just in a more general term, I have been feeling like playing a good 3D platformer. And while discussing options with you, Spyro jumped out as one of those, and I think that was a fantastic idea, so, and extremely timely.
Yep, and I'm looking forward to it.
So, yes, the game for December is going to be the Spyro Remastered Reignited?
Yes.
Whatever that first game in that is called.
To wrap things up, I would like to take a moment and thank Carbohydran and Funk Fiction for letting us use their songs for our intro and outros respectively. Their work is great, and you can check out more by following the links in the description. And with that, we will leave you by saying, game on.